Thanks for listening to Curious Medicine. This episode is not suitable for children. Hi, and welcome back to Curious Medicine. I'm Christy.
Hi, this is Mindy.
Welcome back, everybody. Today we are talking about birth control. Mindy, what do you know about birth control? Do you have any interesting stories?
I just have an interesting method that one of my friends used one time.
Okay.
Which, if I keep telling stories about my friends, my people are going to be like, are you sure? Asking for a friend.
Right, right.
This particular form of birth control was substituted for a condom.
Okay.
It was an everyday household.
Saran wrap.
Close.
What? Oh, not foil.
Not foil. Close. Something you'd
put. Oh, a baggie.
Yeah.
Really? Yeah.
A Ziploc bag.
Well, you know, kudos to your friend, because I dare say most people would be like, it's probably okay.
Let's just do it without.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And how did it work? Like, did it?
I mean, she didn't have a baby.
Well, so we're not advocating any of the things that we're discussing on here today, but I think that's probably better than nothing. It's certainly better than many of the things that we're going to discuss today. Yeah. That have been used in antiquity. So,
very true.
It seems to me your friend is pretty clever. And I wonder, was it
quick on her feet?
Was it her idea or off her feet? She thinks quick on. She thinks quick on her back. I wonder, was it her idea or the guy's idea?
I think she just was going to deny him if he didn't have something, and he scrambled for something.
So interesting.
Yeah.
Huh. Oh, okay. Well, that's one.
Christy's like, duly noted in times of emergency.
Right. I'm like, how many baggies do I have? I have the snack size. I have all the way up to the gallon size. So I'm well prepared for any manner of need.
Very nice.
Should it arise. We're off to a great start, ladies and gentlemen.
Are you going to put the parental advisory?
Before we start talking about the methods of birth control used over the years since ancient times, there's a few things that I want to discuss before we get into the good bits of this. First of all, Mindy, did you know that contraceptives are number 19 on the top 100 famous inventions and greatest ideas of all time?
I didn't, but doesn't the vibrator rank higher than that?
Well,
the info from our hysteria episode?
It should.
Doesn't it though?
It should.
Or no, it was the earliest invention.
Yeah, it was like the mechanical.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I hope vibrators are on that list somewhere. And, you know, it would be perfectly fine with me. Since I'm through having children, it would be perfectly fine with me if it's, you know, ranks higher than contraceptives.
So it's number 19 on the what list?
Number 19 on the top 100 famous inventions and greatest ideas of all time.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Additionally, a little bit of backstory for contraceptives is that there are some psychosocial consequences of using contraception, because across history, attitudes about the use of birth control have changed. Sometimes, you know, culture and society has supported its use, and other times it has condemned its use. And at times, religion has played a very important role on society's opinions.
Yeah.
Birth control in medieval Western Europe was immoral, according to the Catholic Church. Women in this era resorted to various methods, such as coitus interruptus, which we're going to discuss in a few minutes. They also inserted lily root and rue into the vagina, which I'm going to talk more about later.
Okay.
But also infanticide, which to me is one of the saddest things. And then another thing to talk about before we talk about methods is the Comstock Act of 1873. I think actually this might be remember when we did the hysteria episode and I told you that it was against the law, like in 5 states, to own or have possession of like more than 5 more vibrators, than 5 vibrators. And you couldn't carry them across state lines or Sunday. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Could only have the Monday through Friday.
I think this is how those state laws came into being.
Oh, I see.
So this was a federal law, but it is also referred to as the chastity law. The official title was an act for the suppression of trade in and circulation of obscene literature and articles of immoral use.
So no porn.
That's a long one.
Yeah.
No, definitely no porn. But the statute did not provide a definition of obscenity, just as a.
You can find a loophole around that.
Yeah. Okay, so this act made it illegal to send obscene, lewd or lascivious, immoral or indecent publications through the mail. It also made it a misdemeanor for anyone to sell, give away, or possess an obscene book, pamphlet, picture, drawing, or advertisement. So some of the pictures that we're going to talk about later would violate the Comstock Act of 1873. This included writings or instruments, whatever instruments means, pertaining to contraception and abortion, even if written by a physician. So, in short, this act made birth control a federal crime. Many states followed suit, making their own versions of the Comstock Act. We won't delve any deeper into this topic for this episode because there's too many rippling effects of this act over the years, and it goes into Roe v. Wade and all this stuff. So, So now we're going to get into the methodologies. Before we start talking, what do you think is the most effective form of birth control? I mean, I know you did your research. I did mine. But just off the top of your head, or what was your preconceived notion about what?
There is an episode of Roseanne, which Roseanne is my favorite show of all time.
Oh, okay.
When Becky asks her mom to go on birth control, or is asking about what the most effective form of birth control is. And Jackie, if you know Aunt Jackie.
Yes.
Well, she gets around on Roseanne, right? So
right.
She kind of jumps in the conversation and she's like, your best bet is a condom sponge combo. Back when sponges were a thing. And that's what I think about. And I think to this day, your best bet would be a pill and a condom.
Yeah.
But not a sponge. Disagree with the sponge
thing. Yeah. Yeah. Do you feel comfortable saying what forms of birth control you've had?
Just condoms and birth control.
Okay.
And guess what? I ain't got no kids.
Well, I'm a poster child for poor birth control. So, let's see. I have, after I got pregnant with my son, then I wanted to make sure that never happened again. And I have tried the pill, which was, all of these things have been effective, but the pill. And then I've also tried the diaphragm, which I didn't like. I didn't like. We're going to get into that and I'll tell you the reasons why I didn't like it. But
I'm sure it's everything that I think I hated.
Yeah. Yeah. Also condoms, of course. And then also coitus interruptus.
Right.
Of course.
So can I ask, what was your form of birth control when you conceived?
Well, I had gone and gotten on the pill, but they made me so nauseated. And the irony there is that they made me so nauseous. They made me so nauseous that I didn't take them correctly. And so the irony is that I had hyperemesis when I was pregnant. So boy, I mean, it's like if there was ever an argument to be made for taking a pill that makes you nauseous over having hyperemesis when you're pregnant, oh, there it is. But also now I have an IUD and I love it.
My sister just had her second child and they're not ready to make any permanent decisions yet. And she was talking about getting an IUD. And before I had done all this research, I told her, in my profession, things that I see are the migrating IUDs.
Right, yeah.
And so I think I maybe scared her out of it.
Yeah.
So now that we've done all this research, I should go back to her and give her my new opinion.
Well, they can migrate. Okay, so... but I would guess that... yeah, I would think that the pill would be very highly effective and also an IUD. I mean, well, there's lots of things that are highly effective.
Yeah.
But I'm not too much of a fan of the stuff that you have to dig around and get in and out of there.
Agreed.
I just don't, not really, that's not really my thing. Okay.
No, thank you.
So, Mindy, you're going to talk to us about sort of the more physical and or mechanical forms of birth control, which get ready, listeners, because we are here to tell you that there are a multitude of ways in which you can protect yourself against pregnancy.
Correct.
I mean, this list is exhaustive, and we're gonna take a deep dive into the world of contraception. So what would you like to discuss first?
Let's start with coitus interruptus.
Okay. That's probably one of the most...
Well, it is most common. People hear it and they probably won't recognize it. But right. I think today it's referred to as the pull-out method.
Yes.
Right? So yes. Coitus interruptus, also known as withdrawal or pulling out or the pull-out method, is basically a form of birth control in which the man withdraws his penis from the vagina before he ejaculates and directs the semen somewhere else. So that way you don't impregnate.
Mm-hmm. Also called the rhythm method.
Yes, that was also on Roseanne. And Becky said, are there any other forms of birth control? And Roseanne said, yeah, the rhythm method. And Becky goes, does it work? And she said, ask your brother. I love me some Roseanne.
Yeah.
An advantage to the pull-out method is that it's a effective form of birth control for people that don't have any other options.
Yes.
They don't have health insurance. Right. They can't afford condoms, what have you. If it's used properly.
Right.
For coitus interruptus, I think the oldest description was actually in the Bible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I heard that this is one of the oldest methodologies. And also, it was probably the most effective birth control known in antiquity.
Yes, prior to there ever being any kind of condom or anything of the sort. From 2006 to 2010, there was a self-reported survey called the National Data of Family Growth that I think this is peculiar. The failure rate of the pull-out method increased if a woman had previously given birth. And the failure rate increased with the more children she had. So if you had zero children, you only had an 8.4% failure rate. But if you had one child, that failure rate went up to 20.4%. And if you had two or more children, it went up to 27.7% failure rate. I couldn't find why that was, but that was the data from the study.
That is so interesting. Did the article that stated it, were they perplexed as well? Like, were they surprised by those
findings?
Didn't
mention it.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay.
And then a common, argument, at least that I've heard, like why men want to use condoms opposed to the pull-out method is because of quote unquote pre-cum or, pre-ejaculate, which is also called Cowper's fluid. There was debate on whether or not there was actual live semen in the pre-ejaculate, and that could be what's causing pregnancies, even though they pulled out prior to their ejaculation.
Oh, okay. Good point.
So for that reason, and then they also didn't know if sperm was showing up, is it just because of a prior ejaculation that was stuck and then was expelled during the pre-cum? So for that reason, they recommended urinating for men in between ejaculations. That way it's going to get rid of any live semen in there. That way when you do pre-ejaculate, there's no semen in there.
Interesting.
But in 2011, they did a study that most men have a fair amount of motile sperm in pre-ejaculate. So I don't think the old myth of peeing is ever going to help. It's just pre-ejaculate is either going to have motile sperm in it or it's not. And I think it just depends male to male on.
Yeah.
That is one of the downsides of coitus interruptus is.
Yeah. Next up on your list.
coitus reversitus.
Reservatus.
Coitus reservatus.
Reservatus, I think.
Coitus reservatus.
What's that? It's hard to say.
Coitus reservatus. It's also known as sexual continence, and it's a form of intercourse in which the male partner attempts not to ejaculate.
Hmm.
They want to remain at like a plateau phase for as long as possible. I've heard of this as calling it edging.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think Brian described it as edging on the spermatoria episode.
And it's kind of like, I think it's coincidentally a form of contraception, but it's more so like a way of practicing sex and reaching this mystical level of orgasm.
Huh. So,
which can also be used during masturbation. Like, I think that's a thing. Like, you'll masturbate and try not to come, and it's supposed to give you this new elite.
That is the difference orgasm between men and women, right there, folks. I'll tell you what, because Mindy, have you ever gotten close and then tried not to have an orgasm?
You know, I did one time because I said, it's going to happen. And he's like, no, not yet. And so I had to stop myself because I was young and like, oh, I can't go unless he tells me. And then I never came.
Oh my God.
It's like, I'm never missing that opportunity again. I don't know if he says, don't do it yet.
You just be quiet and pretend. Because I always say better than the orgasm is the moment when you are like right there and you know it's going to happen. It doesn't matter what happens next. Doesn't matter what the next few seconds happen. You're coming. And to me, that's better than the actual orgasm.
Well, I think that's the theory behind this. Yeah. They keep you at that moment of magical.
But I don't want to stop it. Like, I don't want to. I don't even want to prolong it. I just, you know, let's just get over the hump and go.
No pun intended.
I'll just take both. All right. What else do you have?
All right. So I also have castration.
Okay.
So there's a few different forms of castration. You have surgical castration and chemical castration.
Okay.
And I'll get into chemical castration here in a minute. But as far as surgical castration, if you remove your ovaries, it's called an oophorectomy. Did I say that
right? I've heard it said.
Oophorectomy?
Oophorectomy or oophorectomy or ovariotomy.
But not oophorectomy.
No, I've not heard oophorectomy. But, you know, you do you, girl.
I think these are most commonly performed in disease prevention if you have ovarian cyst or if you have test positive for the BRCA gene and you're trying to be preemptive against ovarian cancer and things of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the men go, men and women, it's unsure where it was first practiced or why it was invented. But it was frequently used for religious or social reasons in certain cultures like Europe and South Asia.
Like, what kind of culture reason would you castrate people? Because,
well, they would say, like, after battles, you would castrate your enemies if you defeated them as a way to maybe seize their power.
Oh.
And they would do that to both their alive people and corpses.
Huh.
And castrated men, often referred to as eunuchs, which I know you didn't watch Game of Thrones, but I did. And that's the only reason I know what a eunuch is, because they had a character on there who was a eunuch. Is someone who's castrated, a male who's castrated.
Oh, okay.
And they were often admitted to special social classes, and they were primarily used to like staff bureaucracies or palace households or the harem, which in Muslim culture is a place for only the women to go.
Yeah.
So they would send these castrated men there.
Yeah.
Because they were no
safe.
Harm to the women.
Interesting.
And then, you know, we have the castration of animals, which is what we refer to as neutered and spayed. And it's A, for birth control reasons or to help, you know, their behavior, which when it comes to surgical or chemical castration, now that we're going to get into chemical castration, both of them greatly reduce the production of the hormones, like your sex hormones. And it has a great effect on your body.
Mm-hmm.
Chemical castration is not a form of sterilization.
Okay.
It is an aphrodisiac. So an aphrodisiac is to increase your sexual appetite.
Okay.
An aphrodisiac does the opposite.
Okay.
And
so it diminishes your sexual appetite. Yeah,
reduce your libido, your sexual activity. Sometimes it's used to treat cancer.
Uh-huh.
But again, it's not a form of sterilization. They normally do this to reduce sex drive and compulsive fantasies. So in 1944, it was used for the first time to treat sex offenders.
Ah. So was it effective?
It was effective in the sense that it didn't overpopulate the prisons, which I think is why they looked into it.
Uh-huh.
But so many rules and regulations on what the FDA approves and doesn't approve.
Yeah.
I think they started putting restrictions on what kind of sexual offenders. They had to be like a repeat offender or a repeat child molester.
Oh, okay.
And those people get the chemical castration. And I saw a Law and Order SVU episode on this. And
they still do it?
Well, this was fictional TV show.
Yeah,
But they said that he did it. He was a repeat child sex offender.
Yeah.
And he got fat. He couldn't get an erection. Like, it just completely changed all of his hormones, which happens to when you have it surgically removed. You just lose those hormone-producing parts.
Yeah.
And that's just kind of a side effect of what happens. But surgical castration is the one that is a form of sterilization, but not the chemical one.
Yeah.
And then next on my list,
yes,
is chastity belts.
Oh, yes.
Okay, so chastity belts were reportedly, and I say reportedly in quotation marks, worn by women in the Middle Ages to prevent sexual intercourse. And I'm sure you're all imagining something like I'm imagining, like this metal clamp over a woman's vagina.
Mm-hmm.
Supposedly, it's a huge myth. And researchers or, you know, philosophers can find actual documents that state that it was chastity belts were an actual thing. I can only begin to imagine, like, you know, and that's the other thing, too. They couldn't imagine, like, something made of metal with the serrated edges on a woman's vagina did not cause.
Right. No, I know, because I saw this. Okay, so I saw the same thing. I saw where some historians think that the whole concept was a myth. Okay, so you and I today sitting here talking about it, describing this to our wonderful listeners, we would like to say that, you know, we're just going to tell you what we read. Okay.
Yeah.
So some historians think that the whole thing was a sham. Some think that it was an actual thing, but not in the medieval times, but rather in the Renaissance era.
Yeah.
So whatever. I mean, we're not here to debate that. We're just here to talk about, like, let's just assume that they did exist.
Yeah.
Okay. So what I read is a chastity belt is a garment specially designed with a lock. Some were described as having padded linings in order to prevent large areas of metal from coming into direct contact with the skin. These padded linings had to be changed frequently, making it impractical to wear uninterrupted for very long because of the risk of infections, wounds, possibly sepsis, and even death. And gosh, with all those corsets and other stuff women had to wear during those years, this just
they adds insult to injury. All the time.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It was no great life for a woman in the Renaissance era, because these were generally designed for women for the following reasons. Chastity being one, so refraining from sexual intercourse. Also to protect women from being raped. This is a sad world that we live in. And across time, you know, even in ancient times,
rape
you
existed.
Had, yeah, exactly. It's sad. But also to dissuade women and potential sexual partners from sexual temptation. So if you were going to go on a stroll through the garden with the man courting you, you better put on that chastity belt.
You want to know what my chastity belt is today? If I want to stop myself from hooking up with a guy?
What?
I like just let my pubes grow all the way out around 70s bush.
If I'm going to to go on a date and I don't want to, I want to control myself and make sure I don't have sex. I won't shave my legs and stuff.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like, ew.
Although I did that once and I still slept with a guy. So God only knows what he thinks of me.
Okay. There's even one for a man that I saw online. Now, what if men had to go around wearing a device like this? Okay. It's widely believed that these were used in the Middle Ages, but their main period of use was actually during the Renaissance and about the 16th century. The idea really took off in the 19th century and worn as anti-masturbation medical devices.
Oh, Jesus.
Hello. Often prescribed by doctors, probably because they wanted to provide your pelvic massage rather than have you do it yourself.
Wow. So mm-hmm. this was before the vibrator was created for at-home use.
Yes. Interestingly, Mindy, credit for this invention goes to a woman who was an Assyrian queen thought to be a nymphomaniac. She made the women working in her palace wear one so that the men would have sex with her rather than any of the women in the palace.
Okay, I was wondering how that story was going to turn around.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Would you like to see a picture?
Well, I, you know, during my research, all I could find was modern day chastity belts because I guess currently they're kind of like a fetish thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I could see that. I could see that. Okay. First of all, this one right here is probably pretty typical, and it's even labeled. It's labeled. So, yeah. Mindy, do you want to describe that?
It's a picture of a woman wearing it, and then on the other side, it's like a diagram of what it is. The woman wearing it looks like she's wearing a very high-waisted string bikini.
Yes.
And God, it's got a hinge right in the middle and a hole for the anus and a hole for the urethra.
Yes.
That is got to be so unsanitary.
This is what I want to comment on. I mean, look at the size of those holes.
This is the most unsanitary, most uncomfortable looking thing.
Yeah.
Steel belt for the waist. Catches for the lock. Yeah, this is just... I mean, now that you say, like, it was made by a woman, like, it was obviously a scorned, jealous woman.
Like, it makes sense.
It does.
Right? Because only a woman could come up with something this. Like this.
Yes.
A woman that hates another woman.
Yes.
A jealous, woman-hating woman.
Like, the way that the hinge is, where it meets in the middle.
Yeah.
Has got to be... like a pube ripper outer.
Yeah. Can you imagine like sitting down with that?
No.
On?
Oh my God. I'm uncomfortable looking at it. Take it away from me.
Okay. Okay. How about this one for men?
Oh my God.
I mean, okay, I'm sure this is some kind of fetish thing.
Yes. This seems,
I saw it on Google.
Kind of like that. Well, that's the majority of what I came across.
Yeah.
Like kind of a lot of S&M type
sexual
stuff. But this looks like a slinky.
Yes.
Around the penis.
You know what it looks like?
You know what this egg part looks like? Things. Have you ever seen like if you want to wash your baseball cap? Do you know what I'm talking about? That's what the head of this chastity belt looks like for men.
I mean, how do you keep this on?
I mean, and how painful is it if you actually get an erection? And also, it's kind of outward, so you gotta have a semi at least.
I mean, does something like go around your waist to secure it?
Suction,
does something
maybe?
Go underneath between your legs?
I don't know, but I want to know if this is some form of sex toy. Does the woman like? Do you have
sit
intercourse
on it?
With this on? Yeah.
Well, I think the idea is that you don't have intercourse. It's a chastity belt.
Yeah, but not for fetish people.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Okay, one more chastity belt before we go.
Okay.
Okay, good luck with this one.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Okay, I'm looking at picture like a string thong. What do they call
Yes, this yeah. Yeah.
String thong? No, yeah. There's a name for it. A T string or something?
Oh.
G string? I don't sound know. So old. What's it called? A T string? But why isn't it called a T string? It's in the shape of a T. But imagine a G string and there's an opening for the anus and an opening for the vagina. And
let me see.
Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And but they are like serrated edges, so shit can come out.
Which
but
are
if
like
you tried to pointed, go put anything in, yes. It's gonna like cut you up.
It's like, you know how when you go
come on.
When you go into like a parking lot, it's like exit only, and if you reverse, it'll have severe tire
yes,
damage.
Yes, yes, that's exactly what it's like.
You're going to have severe damage yes, to your organs yes, if you yes, try to go forward.
Like, I imagine this one looks more comfortable than the last one to wear, but if you were to ever, like, cross your legs or something when you sit.
I know. And also, I think it's interesting that they have the same serrated edges on the anus hole. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just saying.
Very true.
Okay. All right. What else do you what else do you have on your list, Mindy?
Good old-fashioned condoms. Believe it or not, I think everybody knows about a condom that's made for a male. There are female condoms.
Right.
Which I'll get into in a minute. But the earliest reference of a condom was from ancient Greece, and it states that the material they made condoms out of was of goat bladder, animal intestines.
Yes.
That's what the first condoms were made out
yes,
of. There was also a condom known as the glans condom, and this was Asia's version, and it only covered the tip of the man's penis. And this could be made from anything from animal intestines to silk paper to animal horns and even tortoise shells.
Yeah.
Which sounds really uncomfortable. And also, how did it stay on?
I think it didn't.
No.
Because they said, I read an article where it said, quote, the downside was that they would move during sex and sometimes become lodged inside the woman.
Isn't that like... I mean, how can you have sex and not move? Like,
okay, just first of all,
and then sit there.
First of all, the downside. Like, aren't there many downsides to this? Okay, seems to me like there are other potential downsides, such as this would be painful to the man's penis. Okay, this would be painful to the woman's vagina.
I don't think they were thinking about us.
Okay, this would be a mood killer for the penis. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then also reduced sensation to the penis. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they were called Asian glands condoms, yeah. And they go all the way back to the 14th century.
So around the 16th century, syphilis became prevalent throughout Europe, and it was called the French disease. In an effort to reduce the spread of syphilis, a chemical-soaked linen sheath that fit over the penis was tied on with a ribbon, and that was a condom. Again, not necessarily made for contraceptive purposes, but to help prevent the spread of syphilis. By 1855, the first rubber condom came into existence, thanks to Charles Goodyear.
Mm.
And then by 1920, condoms were invented with latex, and then in 1957, Durex created the first condom with lubrication. And then you went on to advance to fancier things for sexual pleasure, like ribbed condoms and yeah, things like that.
Well, I read a few things that you didn't have in your notes. I read that the earliest ones were made of leather, of all things. I mean, how can a leather condom be pleasurable for the man or for the woman? Okay, and that also they may have used animal fat as a lubricant. Also in ancient times, the Romans used to make them from the intestines of their enemies.
Oh, Jesus.
Mm-hmm. a few more thoughts to ponder about 16th century use of condoms. It's not like men could just go to the store and buy a box of condoms.
Right.
And they only had one, which they had to use over and over again. And this was before the days of penicillin and venereal diseases were rampant. Yeah. In the mid-1500s, physician Gabriel Fallopio, which is the guy who fallopian tubes are named after, he invented the modern condom, which protected against venereal diseases and pregnancy. And the sheaths that you said included the ribbon to tie mm-hmm. it on with, yeah, he's the guy that came up with that. And they used to call them, the name of the condoms were called overcoats.
Ironic.
Some manufacturers even produced medicated fur-lined varieties.
Is that necessary or comfortable?
I mean, they were not popular with men.
Was it
though.
Luxury?
So, no, I don't think it was luxurious. I think it was supposed to be some sort of extra protective.
You know, people that do these studies, they know us humans. So they rate the failure rate based off of proper use of condoms uh-huh. and the typical use of condoms.
Okay, so describe to us the difference between the two.
Proper use is use at every active intercourse before any sexual context or contact is made.
So you don't screw around for a little while and then put
right.
it on.
You don't give the you don't give the chance of the right. pre-ejaculate to come right. or anything like that. 2% failure rate mm-hmm. with proper use.
Okay.
With typical use, hey, we're drunk, let's not worry about getting a condom this time, yeah. or let's fool around a little bit before I put the condom on, 18% failure rate.
Oh, wow. Wow, that's a lot.
Yes, yes. And when you're talking about, aside from the fact that, hey, you're just not using it or not using it properly, failure rates also happen if they break due to improper application, mm-hmm. like they don't know how to put it on, they were never how to, you know, they yeah. were never shown the banana trick.
Yeah.
Degradation of the latex, like it's uh-huh. just an expired condom.
Yeah,
that can happen.
It's been in the glove box.
Yeah, it's been in my wallet. It's caused that yeah. ring in my yeah. wallet. Like I left it there just so yeah. I'd look cool.
Have you ever known a guy that had a ring around his wallet?
No, but it's vividly in my mind. Like it must be in a lot of movies or something. And then another common use of failure rate is when people try to quote unquote double bag it.
Oh.
Where they'll put two condoms on. I imagine people do that like if they think a girl is really nasty.
Yeah.
Or maybe they just super duper don't want to get the girl pregnant.
Yeah.
I've heard the term double bagging, but
yeah.
I don't ever know anybody that's ever actually
yeah.
done it.
Nobody's ever double bagged with you.
No. I should take that as a compliment.
Yes, I think that is I think that's a compliment.
So now we get into the female condom.
Yes. Oh, I cannot wait to talk about this.
You know, it's designed to be worn internally
yeah.
by the female partner. And it looks just like a male's condom, except it goes in reverse.
I beg to differ.
Well, the picture I saw looked like just like a woman, okay. A man's condom.
Okay.
Like it had the long shaft.
Okay.
But that is supposed to go inside of you.
Okay, hold on a second. I want to show you a picture of the female condom that I saw because, I mean, I think it looks like one of those blue vomit bags that we have at work. Look how big that thing is.
Okay.
Is that what you saw?
Well, yeah, but I mean, I didn't see them side by side. That's too big.
Okay.
That's so, too big.
Yeah, that is like
a grocery bag.
Yes, exactly. Yes, it's
that's
like
outrageous.
Yeah. So
I didn't see it in comparison to a male condom.
Yeah.
Like if you just saw that side alone, you'd just think, okay, this looks just like a regular condom. But when it's sitting next to a male condom.
Yeah, I have a few issues with this.
This looks like a grocery bag that's blowing in the wind.
This looks like what this looks like to me is a sleeve for your Coca-Cola can. That's
like
what
a koozie.
Yes, except just made of plastic because it's yeah. got it's about the diameter of a Coca-Cola can.
Yeah. How do you
it's
fit
got
that in there?
It's I got a ring. It's got a ring on both ends of it. you just Google condom versus female condom, you will see a picture of these side to side. So also this looks like plastic instead of latex.
It doesn't look like it would do shit.
Right. And so my thing is like, okay, this was created in the 1980s. These have not caught on too well. No big surprise. If you just take a look at this picture, they're more expensive than male condoms, which of course, because all things for women are more expensive, right down to shaving cream. These are worn inside the vagina and they can also be worn inside the anus. Okay, who is going to put this in their anus as a preemptive measure? Like, who would do this? Okay. And then they're huge in size compared to the male condom. This is what I have in my notes. The inner and outer rings, which some people find makes sex more pleasurable, but look how big the opening of that ring is. No, and look how big the ring of that. I mean, nothing is gonna, yeah, it's not, yeah. I don't even know. And then it says not to be used in conjunction with a male condom as it may cause friction and tear the condoms, either the female or the male's condom. So how in the world do you insert this? I'm assuming that you just insert it similar to a diaphragm where you have to, have you ever inserted a diaphragm?
No.
Yeah. Oh God. Okay. Okay. So you take this ring, you fold it in half on itself, and then you shove it up lengthwise in your vagina and you let go and it opens up, springs open, and it's supposed to go around your cervix at the top of the vagina. But have you ever worn one of those menstrual cups?
No.
Okay. Because
for the pure reason, they, it sounds painful and uncomfortable.
They hurt. Yeah. Yeah. If they're not sitting just right. And also, whose diameter of their cervix and vagina is this big? Yeah. No one's. No one's is this big.
Yeah. No.
And it hangs out of the vagina for like an inch of it hangs out of the vagina. Okay. The instructions say when you're ready to have sex, guide your partner's penis into the external ring. And like, I'm just like, when you're ready to have sex, does this mean like you insert it Saturday morning and you're just waiting for Saturday night? I mean, this makes no sense to me.
Yeah.
So it would be so interesting to know, like, we should start asking our friends, have you ever used a female condom? See if we know anybody that's had one, that's used one.
What I read is that its primary motive for the creation of it is well documented as the refusal of some men to use a condom because of loss of sensation. Next on my list is a pessary. It's a block that was inserted into the vagina with the intention of blocking semen. Egyptians and Mesopotamians would use, believe it or not, crocodile dung to make their pessary.
Mm-hmm.
India and like the Middle East would use elephant feces.
Yeah, I have some articles called them suppositories, but yeah, they're pessaries, and so they're inserts made of herbs. They're similar to a diaphragm, which we're going to talk about.
Dung is herbs?
No, not dung, but they can be made of herbs, or they can be mixed with herbs too. But they're similar to a diaphragm in that they cover the cervix. But you know, the dung is acidic and it acts as a normal spermicide, as a natural spermicide. Do you leave it in there? Like, apparently, right. You leave it in there.
Disgusting. And also, like, you know, if you think of a pessary as a suppository, did they like, you know, compact it and wait for it to harden and then shove it up there?
Well, so what I read is that they were originally used for contraception in early ancient Egypt. The oldest documented evidence of birth control dating back to 1850 BC in ancient Egypt was made of the crocodile dung, which it said was acidic, therefore had spermicidal quality, and also honey, which had an antibacterial quality. So you take the poop and the honey.
The honey would protect you from whatever bacteria the dung
the
had
dung
in it.
Probably, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then also other pessaries could be made of, or were made of, acacia gum, which also has a spermicidal quality. And actually that's still used in contraceptive jellies today. They could also be made of ginger or tobacco juice. or fabric soaked in lemon juice. And the early 10th century Persia made them with elephant dung, cabbages, and pitch, whatever pitch is.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. People were creative back in the day.
Yeah. Well, people were unafraid to
experiment.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So less gross on my list is an IUD.
Okay. Let's talk to me.
So if you don't know what an IUD is, it stands for an intrauterine device. It's a small, often T-shaped birth control device that's inserted into the uterus and it prevents pregnancy. It's long acting and it's also reversible.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when it says long acting, how long? Like 3 years, correct?
So my research said that anywhere from 3 to 12 years, depending on the manufacturer and depending on like, okay, for example, when I had my IUD inserted, I had several choices of the hormonal versus non-hormonal mm-hmm. choices. I chose the hormonal because I was already bleeding like a crazy person. And so I wanted to minimize my bleeding, and the non-hormonal ones are associated with increased bleeding. So I chose a hormonal one. My doctor told me there's two choices that she stocked of the hormonal kind. Did I want this one or this one? And I said, what's the difference? And she said, one FDA has approved for 5 years. One FDA has approved for 6 years. I was like 48 at the time. I wanted it to get me through menopause. Yeah. And so I'm like, give me the longer one.
So you're right. There are two types. There's copper devices or the hormonal devices.
Mm-hmm.
Copper devices have a failure rate of about 0.8%. So very low.
Okay.
Not even a 1% failure rate.
Uh-huh.
They work by damaging sperm and disrupting their motility, so that way they can't join the egg. Specifically, copper acts as a spermicide within the uterus, and it increases the level of copper ions.
Mm-hmm.
But like you said, it does have the side effect of inducing heavy menstrual cramps and a heavy flow.
Yeah.
And then you have your hormonal or levonorgestrel devices. And they fail about 0.2% of the time.
Mm.
So they have a less failure rate than the copper ones. Levonorgestrel, and I'm probably saying that wrong, it's combined with estrogen to make the form of birth control pills. It works by releasing a small amount of that, which is a progestin.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I found this interesting. It's used as an emergency form of birth control, sold under the name Plan B, and you take it within 72 hours. So the chemical that's in Plan B is the same chemical that is inside of an IUD.
Hormone same or hormone, whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
According to one article, the modern day IUD is currently the most effective form of contraception, more effective than even surgical tubal ligation.
Yes.
Okay. In 1909, the first IUD was made from silkworm gut. And it was also like round in shape, circular in shape, but now they're T-shaped, like you said. And yeah, and the whole basis of this is that it prevents fertilization.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. What else do you have?
The diaphragm came into use about 1882, and it is placed over the cervix with spermicide before sex and left in place for at least 6 hours after sex. Now, this is my note where it says fitting by a healthcare provider is generally required.
Oh.
It is moderately effective with a 1 year failure rate of around 12%
mm-hmm.
with typical use.
With a typical failure rate of 12%.
And it may be that high because people put it in by themselves.
Okay. Okay. Fitted for a diaphragm. So it is true that when you, like, if you go to your gynecologist, they're going to look inside your vagina.
Yeah.
And they're going to determine, like, what circumference of a diaphragm you
need.
You
shouldn't just go to the store and buy whatever you
can't.
Size you think
they're by prescription only.
Oh, I see.
So your gynecologist will fit you. And they'll write you a prescription for the appropriate size.
I see.
And then if your weight fluctuates more than like 5 or 10 pounds, you have to go get refitted.
Oh, wow. I didn't know the size of your cervix changed.
Like
with weight gain.
Like the whole thing is just a giant messy,
terrible,
inconvenient
idea.
To me, it was inconvenient thing. I did not like it.
I read, you know, it increases your risk of bacterial vaginosis and urinary tract infections. And if you by chance left it in there for more than 24 hours, you could have toxic shock syndrome. So like, let's say you got laid and then you like pass out and you forget that it's in there.
Yeah.
Which I've heard tampons can actually do the same if you leave them in for too long.
Yeah. Mm. Well, diaphragms were also called womb veils. Have you ever heard of that term?
I haven't, but it seems fitting.
Yeah. Early designs were a rubber hemisphere with a watch spring around the head of the device where it was that it held it in place. And this was supposedly 98% effective, and it was popularized in the 1930s. But I mean, I'm not believing for one second that the one from 1930 was 98% effective and the one from today is 88%. So
no, thank you.
I just think that with all of the choices that women have now, it seems like not the best choice.
Yeah.
What else do you have?
Vasectomy.
Okay.
Every man's favorite.
Snippity snip.
It's during the procedure, the male vas deferens. It's cut and tied or sealed so that way the sperm won't enter the urethra and prevent, obviously, fertilization. It is the most permanent form of contraception, and it's not easily reversed, which was kind of shocking to me because my understanding of a vasectomy is that it is reversible. I think it may be reversible, but the chances of you reproducing after are extremely low. But like I said, it's the most effective and permanent form of sterilization. Failure rate is 1 in 1,400.
Okay.
So, the next one on my list is tubal ligation.
Okay.
Commonly referred to as having your tubes tied.
Mm-hmm.
It's a surgical procedure for female sterilization. And it is considered a permanent method of sterilization for birth control, which, again, I also you can have it, quote unquote, reversed. But I don't think it's that effective if you were to get it reversed. Permanent.
Yeah.
And
permanent. You should just assume that it's permanent if you're going to go that route.
Right.
Yeah.
A common method like that's designed as an alternative to tubal ligation is something called an Escher.
Yeah.
Which is a metal coil that's placed into each of your fallopian tubes, and it induces fibrosis and blockage. So that way it makes your, it basically scars up your fallopian tubes and blocks them. But as of 2015, so many adverse events were reported, including tubal perforations, irretractable pain and bleeding that was leading to hysterectomies, possible device-related deaths, and hundreds of unintended pregnancies occurred.
Yeah.
By the time in April 2018, the FDA completely restricted the sale of Escher, which resulted in 70% decrease in sales. And then also in July of that same year, in 2018, Bayer announced the halt of sales in US by the end of 2018. And I actually watched a Netflix documentary called The Bleeding Edge about Eschers. Watching that documentary was very interesting to me, and I'm unsure if it's still on Netflix, but it is.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's a good documentary, and it has a lot of patient stories.
Yeah, and it's not just about Escher; it has other medical implant devices,
right?
But yeah, it focuses, I think
like metal hip implants.
Yeah, but a significant part is about Escher implants, and I was like you; I was mesmerized because I was like, "Oh my god!"
Yeah,
yeah.
Although it is nice to know. I think a lot of times when you see documentaries like that, nothing's been done. And you're like, how has nothing been done about this?
Yeah.
But something has been done.
Yeah.
And the FDA actually took it completely off the market.
Yeah.
Which is wonderful.
Yeah.
And then the only other option that I have for physical or mechanical is a hysterectomy, which is just the total and complete removal of the uterus.
Yeah. Have you ever heard of coitus obstructus?
I have not.
Okay. So this... I believe this was practiced in ancient China, and it's where pressure is applied to the fore part of the testicle to prevent passage of sperm into the woman. That seems really unsure It does not seem very effective, but it is one thing that men in ancient China practiced.
Interesting.
Also, Mindy, have you ever heard of vasal gel?
I have not.
A male contraception. It's a new type of male contraception, and basically it's a low commitment vasectomy. So rather than cut the vas deferens, which you described for a vasectomy, and also the vas deferens is the tube through which the sperm swim, this technique injects gel into the vas deferens, blocking the sperm temporarily, as if any man is going to do this. Like, this is like...
So you're going through the procedure of a vasectomy without actually getting one.
Right. And so what man is going to do this also? Right. And then would you trust... Because it says this gel can be flushed out when the man is ready to have children. Okay, first of all, I would not trust that gel. I mean, but I'm just thinking, what man is going to go have this done?
No.
They're going to be like,
they're going to go give me no, them the second bruh, so just keep coming back.
Right. Yeah. Like, yeah. Okay. Let's see. There's one other thing in this section that I would like to talk about, and that's douching. So we have talked about the pelvic douche.
Yes.
But instead of having like a pelvic douche, this is like a vaginal douche. So this goes all the way up in there. This began as a form of birth control until the 19th century. In 1832, it became illegal if used after sex as birth control. Although it didn't work to prevent pregnancy, by 1940, it was the most popular form of birth control.
Women, even though it didn't work?
Right. Women often used honey, olive oil, or wine. Or wait for it.
Drinking the wine?
Lysol. Lysol. There's a whole thing about Lysol being used. Okay, so Mindy, let me tell you about douching with Lysol. Because you cannot believe this. Okay. Hundreds of people died from Lysol exposure, some of whom were women using it as birth control. Since birth control was illegal, they had to disguise its intent, and so they advertised it as guarding against odors, which was a euphemism for birth control, and the company created jelly, spray, and foam versions. Despite 193 cases of Lysol poisonings by physicians, Lysol was aggressively marketed to women as safe and gentle. There's an ad that I want to talk about.
For Lysol?
For douching.
Oh, okay.
Mindy, let's take a gander at this.
Okay, it looks like two hippies.
Yes.
Amy doesn't need to douche, but she knows I love apricots. Duff. Love apricots, one of 16 delicious flavors of love from love. This is the most hippie shit I've ever seen, and I don't understand it.
So,
Amy doesn't need to douche, but she knows I love apricots.
I guess Amy's vagina doesn't naturally smell like an apricot, but he loves apricots, so she douches for him because it'll make it smell like apricots.
So it's one of the flavors of love from love. So love must be the brand name of the douche. Yeah,
maybe it's like a summer's eve, you know, or... Yeah. So that pretty much covers the physical and mechanical.
Correct.
Methods of birth control. Moving on to medicinal and herbal methods. Mindy, have you ever heard of mugwort?
No.
Okay. It's some kind of herb or plant. And its like official name is Artemisia. And anyway, in the 12th century texts, it described this as a menstrual tonic. And the 14th century text describes its use in expelling dead fetal tissue after miscarriage.
Interesting.
This was used to induce abortion, like so early abortion.
induce abortion. So, but not to just clear out like a spontaneous abortion.
Well, it could. It could do that too. It would make the uterus contract.
Okay.
But there were many, many things that women ingested that were abortifacient, and this was one of them.
Mm. Mugwort.
Yeah, and it mugwort.
Sounds even worse.
And it was also an intoxicant.
So you could like get drunk off of it?
I guess so, yeah. Okay, the next thing on my list is copper. Drinking copper dissolved in water. Hippocrates claimed that this would prevent pregnancy for 1 year.
So kind of different. I mean, we've established that the copper that's in IUDs, you know, is right. a spermicide, but ingesting it
right.
is supposed to prevent it for I one mean, year.
Maybe you get metal poisoning.
We don't like Hippocrates though, right? Like, just a general like agreement. We don't like Hippocrates, right?
I mean, I like Hippocrates, but I mean,
I love to hate him.
We love to go, come on, Hippocrates, come on. You know.
Yeah.
The onion, really?
I know.
Yeah. Okay. The next thing we're going to talk about is the morning after pill. It's also called Plan B.
Yeah, yeah.
It's also referred to as an emergency contraception.
I do have a funny story about Plan B.
Okay, tell me before I talk about it.
Okay. I fooled around with this guy one night. We yeah. did not have sex. He was obviously too wasted to remember that we did not have sex.
Oh.
So he texted me the next morning and said, I'm worried about last night.
Yeah. You
know? And I said, I think we're fine. And he goes, no, you should take Plan B. And I said, oh, I really can't afford that right now. He said, don't worry, I got you. Came over, gave me $50, and your girl went to the bar that night.
So this is used to prevent pregnancy after unprotected sex or following a, quote, contraceptive accident. It's one dose of the levonorgestrel yeah. that you described yeah. and so aptly pronounced. It can prevent pregnancy if taken within 72 hours, although preferably within the first 12 hours. There is also pennyroyal, which is an herb or a plant that ancient Greeks and Romans drank. Pennyroyal tea to induce menstruation and abortion. Progestin birth control pill. The pill. Let's talk about the pill. The birth control pill was originally submitted to the FDA for approval as treatment for menstrual disorders, as researchers feared it wouldn't be approved as a contraceptive. The side of the box included a warning that this pill is likely to prevent pregnancy, so doctors just began prescribing this as off-label.
Okay.
These are the early birth control pills. Okay. So the way that these worked are that pregnant women release progesterone when they are pregnant, which tells the ovaries not to release any more eggs. And then progestin, which is a synthetic version of progesterone, is used in these oral contraceptive pills. Early birth control pills in the 1960s contained a higher dose of this progestin, at least higher than it is used now. And it had side effects such as nausea, irritability, weight gain, depression, mood swings. I think even in the 1980s, it must have had a higher.
I think a lot of women still won't take birth control because of the weight gain and the mood swings.
Yeah. Well, mine, I just remember it making me very nauseous.
Yeah.
There's also research for a men's birth control pill.
Is it ready to hit the market? Because I'm about ready for it too.
It is not. And It's research has been done for a daily hormone birth control pill for men, which lowers their testosterone levels to the equivalent of castration to avoid low libido and decrease sexual function. Yeah. Study participants were given testosterone with a steroid, but I don't understand if they're purposely lowering their testosterone levels to the right, point of castration. Why would you give? Right. Yeah. So I don't really understand how it works, but I know that there has been research and there's no such pill yet.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. But there should be one. You're like, to hit
yeah,
the
I know. So some other things that you know, secrete hormones or whatever, similar to the birth control pill or the patch that you wear. The Depo-Provera shot, aka Depo shot, it works like the pill. It just, you know, it's a hormone.
Yeah. Is it one shot?
It's my understanding that you get it at certain intervals. Quarterly?
Yeah.
I'm thinking it's quarterly. I think it's every few months. Have you heard of the NuvaRing?
I have.
What do you know about the NuvaRing?
All I know about the NuvaRing is that I equate it to a diaphragm and whatever menstrual cup thing there is. And I just equate it to being just as uncomfortable as that.
Yeah. I have a friend that has one. Friend, if you're listening, you'll know that it's you.
Is it actual ring?
It is a ring. Once you place the NuvaRing in your vagina, it releases a continuous low dose of hormones.
You do it or a physician does
it? You do it. Yeah, this is an in and out thing. So it releases a continuous low dose of hormones that help prevent pregnancy. The hormones are absorbed by the vaginal lining, and you insert this into the vagina around the cervix and leave it in for 3 weeks. You remove it for one full week, and then you insert a new one the same day of the week as the original, same time of day.
No.
Convoluted is that?
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
No. I have no interest in the NuvaRing.
Honestly, like, patients have a hard enough time remembering to take the pill.
Right. Right. Yeah, this is too...
too convoluted.
Okay, another herbal or medicinal form of birth control was Queen Anne's lace. It was also called wild carrot. It was described by Hippocrates. It had no significant side effects. Modern research has shown that this does have postcoital anti-fertility properties by blocking progesterone synthesis, which disrupts implantation. This is most effective when taken within 8 hours of exposure to sperm. It's kind of like the morning after pill.
Okay.
So... this is currently used. I know. This is currently used in India and rural North Carolina.
Why is there such a delicate name like Queen Anne's lace and then
also
wild
known,
carrot? Also like known this is what they call it in carrot. England, and this is what they call it in Kentucky.
Okay. Rue. Latin American women have traditionally eaten this in salads as a contraceptive. Second century Greeks drink this in tea to induce abortion.
Is it a leaf?
It's some kind of herb.
Okay.
Regular ingestion decreases blood flow to the endometrium, which ultimately affects implantation. It also augments sperm and dampens the desire for coitus.
So it decreases libido.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That makes me think of Rue from The Hunger Games.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And what did that do?
Well, I mean, she was this cute, innocent little girl. So I bet her parents didn't know it was Rue was a form of
It was the name of a person?
Yes.
Oh.
Now decreased libido is all I'm going to think about whenever I see her.
Yeah.
It's sad.
Sorry. Okay. Let's give you something else to think about. Okay. How about silphium?
Silphium
was also called laserwort. It was like a giant fennel plant. And
I don't know what a fennel plant is.
Fennel. It's like, you know, a leafy green and white.
It's a plant.
It's a leafy green and white vegetable that people eat.
Okay.
Like you can buy it at the grocery store.
Okay.
It's probably near the shallots. where the rich people shop for produce in that section, in the rich people produce section. It would only grow in a very specific region, which is now like present day Libya. It was an aphrodisiac. It was apparently effective birth control, and one Greek gynecologist recommended drinking silphium juice with water once a month to prevent conception or to destroy anything existing. So I guess it could induce abortion.
You know, with all the research that we've done about how, like, women primarily back in the day, like, our main objective was to reproduce.
Right.
How many forms of contraception there were.
Yeah. But also, you know, when we were doing our pregnancy test episode, I remember saying, you know, why were women so concerned about finding out if they were pregnant? Like, this has been very enlightening to me.
Right.
Because I just didn't know that women, I don't know, I guess.
Yeah, you just think back in the day, like, they all had the mindset of childbearing. Like, yeah, this is what I do.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm so, damn. And I call myself a feminist.
Okay, back to silphium. It was worth its weight in silver in 2nd century BC. It was used for about 500 years, and over-harvesting drove the plant to extinction.
So you can't buy it anymore then.
Right. No, it's extinct. Okay, here's an interesting tidbit. Silphium seed pods were shaped like a heart, and historians believe that the plant's association with sexuality and passion is the reason that love and the heart symbol became synonymous. Aww. Okay, and then we had spermicides, which is kind of self-explanatory. There was also 1,000 of gold contraceptive prescription, which comes from the 7th century. It was made of oil and quicksilver, which is liquid mercury. This oil and liquid mercury were heated together for one day and then taken orally. This caused terrible side effects, such as sterility.
It was taken, like, as a liquid?
Yeah, like, you ingested it. And it would cause sterility, kidney failure, brain damage, and even death. And
mercury poisoning.
Yeah. If you listen to, like, the episode about mercury, we talked about the dangers of exposure to mercury.
I told Christy this, but I don't think I've said it in a podcast. And I think it was your mercury episode.
Uh-huh.
How many times you guys talked about Mad Hatters.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And, like, going down a rabbit hole, and you never made the reference to Alice in Wonderland in the entire episode, but you kept talking about Mad Hatters and
down a rabbit hole.
And I'm like, how have you not made an Alice in the Wonderland joke?
I say down a rabbit hole in almost every episode, but I've never seen Alice in Wonderland.
I mean, it's not my favorite, so I don't really remember, but you remember the Mad Hatter.
I know
about
the Mad
down
Hatter.
A rabbit hole, and multiple times in that episode. I mean, I was just like, where's the pun? Where's the joke? When is the joke coming? And it never came.
It's
and
because
I
don't know that reference. Now my jaw is clenched up. Okay.
Brian, if you're listening, I'm disappointed in you. Yeah.
I'll tell him. I'll tell him to make sure he listens. Okay. There was another plant called worm fern. It was also called the prostitute root. Yeah. And then ancient China, after intercourse, women drank juice from tadpoles cooked in mercury, which led to sterilization in some women.
So, like, see, I just wonder, like, how do you know it caused sterilization in some women? Like, were you just drinking mercury with tadpole juice and you just noticed that happened? This is all making me think about, like, you know.
Well,
like,
maybe.
Like, who was the first person to milk a cow, you know?
Right, yeah.
What were they doing?
What made you decide to squeeze those things?
Exactly. It just makes you curious about.
Why not squeeze the tail? Yeah.
It makes you curious.
Yeah. I know. That's why this podcast exists.
Yeah.
I know, because I'm just like, what?
Yeah.
A few other methods which don't fit into either the physical and mechanical or herbal medicinal abortion. Mm-hmm. So we're not going to get into that because that is way too controversial.
Agreed.
Amulets. An amulet is an object carried by a person and endowed with special powers of protection. During the Middle Ages, some people wore amulets made of mule's earwax. That sounds disgusting. A bone taken from the right side of a black cat.
Okay. Oddly specific.
I know. And weasels. Like witch's brew. Yeah. And how about this? Weasel's testicles. A 12th century female medical guide advised women to cut off the testicles while they were alive, wrap them in goose skin, and wear them as amulets if they wanted to avoid pregnancy.
Can't you hear that concoction in like a witch's like, yes, double toil, right, and trouble? Like, here's mule's earwax.
Yeah, yeah. Take a pinch of mule's earwax and a bone from the right side of a black cat on Halloween. But this weasel's testicles was the go-to method for birth control in Europe at the time. And then there's compulsory or coercive sterilization, which is, these were especially performed on the mentally unwell persons in the early 1900s. Mm. Incantations, which are magic spells or charms. Okay, infanticide is another one. This is killing of the newborn, which has often been interpreted as a primitive method of birth control. There's also lactation and breastfeeding for up to 3 years. I did not remember that this was a thing. Now that, I mean, like once I read about it, I was like, oh yeah, I think I remember that. But I had forgotten. But women did it, and the modern term is lactational amenorrhea or postpartum infertility. This is temporary postnatal infertility that occurs when a woman is fully breastfeeding and not menstruating. This was practiced in ancient Egypt and likely many other places too. Okay, the squat and sneeze method by Greek gynecologist from 2nd century, whose name was... Dun, dun, dun. Name was Serenus. Serenus. Serenus was his name.
Are you pronouncing that correctly?
Well, it's S-O-R-A-N-U-S.
Oh, Jesus.
So how would you say it? Serenus.
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe he's been squatting and sneezing too much.
This is the same guy who... So I guess the squat and sneeze method is like after sex, you're supposed to squat and sneeze.
Right.
This is the same guy.
Was the male just throwing pepper at the woman to initiate a sneeze?
I don't know what Serenus said about
you
that.
You don't know what Serenus had in mind?
I don't know what he had in mind. But he's the same guy who advised women to jump backwards 7 times after sex and drink the water that blacksmiths used to cool their metal. Speaking of metal poisoning, Mindy, women in World War I volunteered to work in lead factories because they were hoping that they'd become sterile.
Oh my God.
I know. That's how desperate women did not want to get pregnant.
I love women. I do. And I feel bad. Like I said earlier, feel bad that my thought of women back in the day was that everyone just wanted to pump out babies.
Right. That they just didn't have a mind of their own.
A choice. Yeah.
Or their own independent thoughts.
Yeah.
Or interests.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Before we wrap this up, a few behavioral methods. So there's abstinence. I mean, obviously that's the safest.
Actually, in reference to something that has the highest failure rate, abstinence has the highest failure rate.
Because people don't abstain. Because they just can't control themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean.
Right. Because it's not effective.
I mean, when you,
otherwise, my mom every high school student would never get pregnant.
My mom put me on birth control when I was a teenager, not only because, you know, we want to regulate your cycle and whatnot, but she also wasn't stupid. And she told us that.
Yeah.
I'm not stupid. And kudos, I'm going to educate you mom. And I'm going to tell you this.
Yeah.
But you need to like prepare. And I think, my parents had three girls. And I think after my youngest sister was 17, they both like high fived each other. Like,
we had three girls
and didn't have one who was 16 and pregnant.
Yeah. Kudos to your parents.
Yeah.
Okay. How about this behavioral method? Have you ever heard of bundling?
No.
Okay. Bundling was...
I'm thinking of like large orders and you bundle things together.
No. In the early 18th century, men and women entertaining the prospect of marriage would often participate in this ritual where they would spend the night together, fully clothed, separated by a board. Wooden board and sewn into a sack.
Sewn into a sack.
The people and the board between them. Yeah. So you and your prospective
partner
have board in between you. And then your family sews you into a sack and says, see you in the morning.
That's supposed to prevent you from having sex?
Well, the purpose of this was so that the couple could determine if there was chemistry between them. And many women ended up pregnant despite being fully clothed with the board between them.
I mean, yeah, because...
Well, I think it just goes to show where there's a will, there's a way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very true.
I mean, and religious leaders ended up putting a stop to this practice. But, you know, it's funny because even before I did this research, I was listening to a podcast and they had a guest podcast host on a show and they were kind of advertising their show, and the show is called Ridiculous Romance, and they talked about this.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so I thought this was interesting.
Yeah, I've never heard of that.
I mean, they talked about other things too, but this was interesting. And I also thought it was interesting that people back in the day did this because it seems so taboo. Because, you know, this was sort of done like the Victorian era-ish.
Yeah.
And they were just so uptight then.
Yeah.
But also they were going for their pelvic massages, so who knows? Okay, and then another behavioral form of birth control is masturbation. So, you know, if you're taking care of yourself, then you're not going to be worrying about getting pregnant. One other thing that I just want to talk about, well, two other things that I just want to talk about is Margaret Sanger. She was many things, but for the purposes of this podcast episode, she was first and foremost a birth control advocate who challenged that Comstock Act that we talked about at the very beginning. She was arrested in 1916 for opening the first birth control clinic in America. This led to the 1918 Crane decision, which permitted women to use birth control for therapeutic purposes. Okay, and one last thing to talk about are witches.
I'm here for this combo.
Okay. Women and midwives who had the technical expertise and knowledge of herbs were sort of singled out and
labeled as witches.
There was a Witch Bull of 1484, which was a publication issued by Pope Innocent VIII, which recognized the existence of witches and gave permission to do whatever it took to move against them. At this time, witches were accused of causing abortions, hindering men from performing sexual acts, and hindering women from conceiving. And other authors at the time accused witches of infanticide and having the power to steal men's penises. All right, well, on that note, we're going to wrap this up. And thank you, everybody, for listening. Tell your friends about us if you like us. And yes. Join us next week when we discuss a whole new topic.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.